It went straight down the middle. Then it started to...
Welcome to another edition of For the Good of the Game. And Bruce Devlin, let's let our listeners know that this is a historic day on the calendar. This calendar today is unique. It features the numbers 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2. But our guest, another two. But our guest has decided to one-up the twos today, hasn't he?
Well, I got to tell you, our guest today, I'll give you a little bit of background. He's had 21 victories on the PGA Tour. He was the two-time winner of the Players Championship, which a lot of people think is a major too. And then he added the 1997 PGA Championship to it. And I got to tell you, it's a great pleasure and an honor to have Davis Love III with us today. Davis, welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bruce and Mike. I'm looking forward to this. And twos are good on the scorecard too, aren't they? So,
yeah, sure they are.
Hopefully I can get some twos and spread them out over this next year.
There you go. Great idea.
Speaking of twos, my podcast partner had one of four twos on a par five during the Masters way back when, didn't you?
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Only four guys ever did that. They did it all at a different hole. Well, let me see. One was 35, one was 67, one was 93, and the other was 2002. You can name them, Davis, can't you?
No.
I know Mike can. He'll tell you what the four are.
Well, I certainly remember the Sarazen one. That was the most famous one, right?
Right. Yeah. I've heard around the world.
Yeah. Exactly. Sarazen, myself, our friend from the Woodlands, Jeff Maggot.
Maggot.
And then Oosthuizen did it at number two in, I guess, 2012, I think, was it?
Pretty recent.
That's about right. That.
Yeah. And he made a hole in one at 16 as well, didn't he? One year?
I think so, yeah.
Wow.
Anyhow.
He's come close a lot there.
Thanks for joining us today. And as we've talked, we want to tell your story. And to do that, of course, we'll go back to the beginning, you growing up as a young man. But before we get going, this is sort of unusual for us because, you know, we're talking to a lot of older guys typically. So you're a fairly young guy and still active on actually two tours. I think you're trying to play a little bit on both, I think. And unfortunately, you were scheduled to compete this week, but kind of down for the count temporarily, aren't you?
Yeah, my doctor shut me down a little bit. And at almost 58, that's not unusual to have something get out of whack and then the doctor shuts you down. But I am trying to play a little bit on both tours. I had my hip replaced last summer and tried to bounce back from it real quick and probably played a little too much golf and not enough working out after I started back. So a little bit of a restart on the rehab. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to playing, hopefully, a pretty full schedule this year and next year.
Well, good. And this, of course, this affords us an opportunity to spend some time with you because you found yourself with some downtime this week. And Bruce, we've heard from a lot of guys, particularly the guys that are older than Davis. Nobody escapes the injury, man, do they? Sometime in their career, you're going to run into something that's going to set you down for a while.
I know he's complaining about the problems he has at 58. I'm going to ask him to find a way to give me some information when he gets to my age at 84 or nearly 85. I got to tell you, we're at our age, we're happy to sort of get up and be able to talk to a guy like Davis Love. It's been a pleasure watching him play, and he won't remember it, but I remember when his daddy was the head pro at I think it was Atlanta Golf Club, where we played the Atlanta Open years and years and years and years ago. And I remember this young boy coming in there with this magnificent swing. And the one comment I remember more than anything else, Davis, was some guru golf teacher said that Davis Love is the only player that extends the arc from the top of his golf swing.
Yep.
Do you remember anybody saying that?
Yeah, and they put it on the cover of a magazine too.
so So you know how far I go back with you. Yeah. You were just a young boy then.
Right. And my dad said, well, he really doesn't get wider coming down, but he keeps his width better than anybody we've seen in a long time. So
yeah, that's right.
I think that's what Jack Nicklaus did too. You know, his swing was big and wide and stayed wide. And then Tom Weisskopf, guys like that, that were the early long hitters. They kept that width really well.
Yeah.
So Davis, let's just go to the beginning if we can. Growing up as a young man in Georgia, and I guess you were born in Charlotte, so you can take us through the earlier years. But tell us a little bit about that.
Well, when I was born, my dad was a pro at Charlotte Country Club, and before I turned a year old, he was the pro at Atlanta Country Club, as Bruce said. So I grew up my early golf years at Atlanta Country Club and watching professional golf in my backyard. In fact, the very first Players Championship was at Atlanta Country Club, won by Jack Nicklaus. So I had a lot of inspiration, not only from traveling around with my dad to professional golf tournaments, including some majors, but also watching the pros play in my backyard and seeing Bruce Devlin come through my pro shop and my golf course. And I was just inspired as a kid by my dad and by watching golf tournaments. That's what I wanted to do. And then we moved when I was right at 15, moved down to Sea Island. And then I was kind of starting over with no friends and my dad to play golf with, which was a blessing. And I just poured myself into golf from 15 to really when I hit the tour. I didn't do anything other than play golf. Now my mom or my wife would tell you that that I found too many other hobbies now. But for that period, probably from 12 to 20, I didn't do anything other than try to prepare to play on the PGA Tour, and obviously was blessed with a great teacher in my house.
Yeah, what a great way to start in the game with. Your dad was quite a player as well. Not only was he a great teacher, but he was a pretty good player too. I believe he played at Augusta, I think it's 64, would it be? Something like that.
Right. He played in 64 and I was born the day after the Monday after the Masters. And he played as an amateur. He made it into the whatever quarterfinals of the amateur, whatever it was back then. So he played as a very young kid, like a teenager, played in the Masters and then one other time as a pro and had some good finishes. And he would get in, he'd play the PGA Club Pro and he'd get in the PGA Championship. Then he'd finish in the top 20 or something. Then he'd get in the Open Championship. And one year he finished fifth or sixth in the Open Championship. And that got him in everything the next year. So he could parlay a few tournaments into some nice trips for his kids. I remember going to Tanglewood for the PGA and places like that. And it was so much fun to go watch my dad play at an age where I was 10 or 12 years old, where I could appreciate it.
Yeah, I think Tanglewood was won in 74 by Lee Trevino. So you would have been there.
That's right. I was mostly hung out in the locker room because I figured out I didn't like walking that hilly course. So I literally helped with the shoes, the guy in the locker room. Back then, you didn't have to have tickets and passes and all that kind of stuff to get around the clubhouse. So my dad would just park me in the clubhouse and he'd go play and I'd catch up with him at the turn or something. But yeah, that's how I got to know Jackie Nicklaus, because we were both kids following our dads around golf tournaments and ended up playing with Jackie at the University of North Carolina. So I had, you know, very early on had relationships with professionals that I saw at my club or that I saw at tournaments. And then obviously my dad with the Golf Digest schools, we kept that going with famous teachers. I got to play golf with Sam Snead a whole bunch because he was working in the Golf Digest schools with my dad in the summer. So I was very blessed growing up to be around the pros. And I say that about my son. If we could get him onto the tour, he'd be real comfortable because he grew up on the tour, like Bill Haas. I didn't think Bill Haas was, you know, he was a really, really good player in college. I didn't know if he was going to make it to the tour. But if I knew if he made it, he'd be okay because he grew up inside the ropes, wearing some of my hand-me-down shirts. So. I had that blessing of being able to hang around the pros and the teachers and be inspired, but also learn from them.
So you mentioned something I can relate to, having moved at age 15 as well. What do you recall about that? Because that's sort of traumatic, middle, you know, moving in the middle of high school for a young guy, having to make new friends. How did that affect the development of your game and just life in general?
Well, it was again, I've had so many blessings in my life. It was perfect timing. You know, you're about to go into high school. You're in a new place. Your dad's at the golf course every day at a five-star, five-diamond resort. And I just went out to the golf course every day with him and practiced and played. Obviously got on the golf team and made friends to play golf with. But I said, if somebody had taken me surfing when I moved to Sea Island, I'd have been in trouble because that's all I would have done. So thank goodness I got out to the golf course and hung out. So and then great weather, a lot of places to compete. So it was perfect timing for obviously for my family to get to be able to move to the beach. We used to come to Sea Island on vacations, but that we got to come to live at the beach and great golf courses. And obviously back then they were great. Now it's just unbelievable what Sea Island has, golf performance centers and great teachers and great, even more great golf courses. So we have, I don't even know the number, 15 guys living here with PGA Tour cards and a bunch of Korn Ferry guys and a bunch of Drew Loves that are trying to make the tour. So it's an incredible place for pros and for kids to learn how to play the game.
It sure is a beautiful spot you've got down there. And Bruce, you can remember this perhaps better than I, but as you look back on the 30 plus major championship winners we've talked to, we always talk about how they developed, learned the game and so forth. It's generally from their father, but other than maybe a Dave Stockton, I'm not sure I recall another pro we've talked to who grew up with a father that was a professional.
That's right. That's true. And like we said before, Davis's daddy was a very good player and had a fabulous reputation as a teacher. And that a lot of people say, boy, it's unfair that Davis Love could have all that attention when he was so young. But he's turned into a man who is respected by everybody that's ever played the game too, Mike. I can tell you that for sure. Davis Love's got a great personality. He's a great player, but he's a good gentleman too.
Well, thank you. That my dad didn't demand that I play golf or play good golf, but he demanded that I listen to my mom and use my manners and be honest and straightforward and look out for other people. So my mom would say I should have made a few more putts, but I sure was polite. she certainly took over for my dad when he passed away as my motivation. You know, she was a great player. She was a single digit handicap for over 40 years and shot her age for from 73 or 4 to 89. She shot her age. So she was really the best player in the family, but she certainly we had to beat my mom before we could even take on my dad. So she was a great influence on my game as well.
So, Davis, as a young man learning under your father, maybe you can take us through some of the step changes that your game experienced as you aged from a very, very young boy to, you know, teenager approaching the college years. Were there certain step changes that you can look back on?
Well, when I was a kid, we were just out there playing and having fun. And I think that's one thing I tell parents when they ask me, what should I do with my kids? I say, you better make sure it's fun or they're not going to want to go to the golf course and they're not going to want to practice and play. So our dad let us drive the cart and get the rake and go fish balls out of the creek and go fishing if we wanted to go fishing. But as I had goals and started playing in tournaments, you know, at 10 or 12, he said, well, if you're going to work at it, you have to do what I tell you. And then at about 14 or 15, he said, what's your goal? And I said, I want to be a pro like you. I want to play on the tour. And he said, well, now there's going to be some rules and there's going to be practice plans and I get a vote and you get a vote, but your body gets a vote on the instruction, but you have to follow the rules of practice. And then it became a coaching parenting, sports psychologist, teacher relationship that just got us closer and closer together. Sure, we had an argument every once in a while, but mostly over schoolwork, but sometimes over golf. But I had just a great relationship and trust with my dad that whatever he told me, I was going to make me a better player. So I just remember serious swing instruction, you know, way before I had a driver's license or knew that it was fun to chase girls. I was working on my swing plane, doing drills that I saw in the Golf Digest schools. Or I always say I've had a lot of surgeries, but probably a lot of them are from doing left-hand onlys and hitting balls off my knees and pushing my body. You know, Tiger, Brooks, Dustin, those guys are pushing their bodies now like nobody was doing back when I was a kid. But I hit a lot of golf balls, and I hit a lot of left-hand onlys and did a lot of right-hand off after impact drills and things like that, that my dad was setting me up to build a big golf swing to be able to compete on the tour.
Interesting.
And you learned then how to practice productively at an early age.
Yeah, he was big on, and obviously this is before sports psychology, he was big on, all right, we're going to hit 300 putts from 3, 4, and 5 feet. And then that's your short putting drill for today. Or we're going to hit this whole basket of balls left hand only. Or we're going to park the cart on the edge of the green, and we're going to hit over the cart, through the cart, under the cart, chip shots until you get them all on the green. There was always a goal and a purpose and a drill. You know, I worked with some great teachers since my dad passed away, you know, Butch Harmon and Jack Lumpkin, and they were always giving me the same kind of simple Harvey Penick, just a simple drill or a simple thought, but here's what, how you're going to work on it. Here's how long you should do it. Here's what it should feel like. And then we're going to try to transfer that to the golf course. So I was just very lucky that I had not just lessons, I had coaching on how to play golf at a very young age. And so did my brother, you know, to Bruce's point. Yeah, well, you should be a great player because you grew up in a house with a pro. Well, my brother didn't play on the tour. He's a really good athlete, probably a better athlete than me, and a really good golfer. But, you know, I dug it out of the ground a little bit harder than he did. And mm-hmm. I wanted it a little bit better than he did. And sure, I hit it a little bit longer than him too. But, you know, I was given the opportunity, just like a lot of these kids now. You can take them to the Sea Island Golf Performance Center and get them great lessons, but they have to work hard at it to get good at it.
So after you were you went to high school, you then went to UNC on a college. Did you go there on a scholarship?
I did. It was strange. The places that I really thought I wanted to go to as a kid, University of Texas, where my dad played for Harvey Penick and Ben Crenshaw and Tom Kite and the whole thing, they didn't even talk to me. And then some schools like Oklahoma recruited me, and Oklahoma State didn't. So I didn't have a great junior record. I wasn't Scott Verplank, you know, or mm-hmm. Billy Andrade, you know, these hotshot junior players. I was just a good player from South Georgia. But Coach Brouse at UNC and a few others saw that I had some potential. Obviously, I was long, even in high school, raw talent. But I wanted to go to Carolina. I was born in Charlotte. I loved Tar Heel basketball my whole life. So I say I went to North Carolina to watch basketball, and then second, play golf, and third, go to school. And that's probably why I was only there 3 years. It was a hard school for a guy that wasn't trying very hard.
But you had a pretty good career, didn't you? Three-time All-American. You won several titles, individual titles there, and won a few important tournaments, participated in the Walker Cup. Just take us through a little bit of those experiences.
Well, college golf was so much fun. We had five freshmen come in all at the same time. We had a great, great class of guys. I had John Inman. You know, Joe Inman was on the tour. John Inman was one of the best college players every year that I was, the 2 years we played together. And I was just lucky to have a guy like that to chase. you know, John won the NCAAs while we were there. He was a first team All-American probably every year. And we had a great team and it was a lot of fun, but I saw the writing on the wall academically. And what my dad did every year, kind of like Jack Grout did for Jack Nicklaus, is he would assess me in the winter. Here's what we need to work on. And here's where you're going to be next year. And so after a few years of school, when he said, well, I think you could make it out on the tour and you'd probably win in your second year, I said, well, then I'm leaving school. And he was dead right. I made it to the tour, first time through Q school. And my April of my second year on tour, I won a tournament. And that is exactly what he told me I could do. He believed a lot in my game. He gave me not only swing instruction, but he gave me great confidence. When I didn't play well or when I did play well, he was really good at, he called it the blow by blow. We'd go over every shot of the round or of the tournament. And, I went into competition, maybe a little bit ahead of sports psychology, that I was very confident in my ability. And if my dad told me I could do it, I knew I could do it. One time I hit it in the woods. We were playing family golf and I hit it in the woods on a par five at home, and I slashed a 4-iron up on the green over a lake. And he goes, the two most exciting players to watch in the game right now are Seve Ballesteros and Trip Love. That's what he called me. And I said, if you're a kid watching Seve and your dad is a world-class instructor, and he says, I like watching you play just as much as Seve Ballesteros, it gives you a lot of confidence.
I guess.
Like Tiger did for his dad. He didn't give him a whole lot of golf lessons, I don't think, but he made him mentally tough and mentally confident. And that's another thing my dad did. And he was at Bruce, you know, I mean, he was a very clever guy. When sports psychology came out, he went and got Bob Rotella and said, tell me about this sports psychology stuff. And then he let Bob write a chapter in his book when my dad really didn't even understand what he was talking about. My dad was like, I have two towels, one's for the clean the clubs and one's to wipe the blood off my hands because I'm hitting so many balls. He saw that Bob Rotella had a better way to do it. And he told me two things when you go to the tour. You do whatever Tom Kite tells you and go work with Bob Rotella. So he didn't send me out there saying, I have all the answers for you, go play golf. He said, you need to learn from Tom Kite. You need to learn from Bob Rotella how to play the game and how to play the tour. And I just followed the rules. So many people, obviously Jack Klumpkin just passed away recently. I'm going to have to find a new teacher. And people always say to me, you still need golf lessons? And yeah. Bruce, we all have bad habits and somebody's got to remind us to get out of them.
They always sneak back the same way, too. You need somebody from the outside looking in because you can't see yourself from outside.
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
Yeah, we had a recent guest whose name escapes me now. Bruce, you can help me if this was Stadler, who mentioned that, every time I went back to my teacher, invariably, I'd come back on tour and do really well for a while.
It was Stads. It was, yeah. It was Craig Stadler said that, and he didn't even have. He said he didn't even have to hit balls, Davis. After he'd been with his coach, he said, I might take 30 days off and then go play in a golf tournament and damn near win it or win it. He said, one time I took 45 days off, and the first tournament I played in, I won. So I don't know.
It's like Bruce Litsky.
It can happen anyway, right, Davis?
Yeah, Bruce Litsky would put him away for weeks and just come right back out and never, like he never let up.
And of course, Stadler mentioned Lidsky's name quite often too, because he said he was like the second Lidsky, the way he practiced.
Bruce hit balls to warm up at the tournament, so that was about it.
Yeah, amazing, really.
You mentioned advice from your father about listening to what Tom Kite tells you. What did you learn from Tom Kite?
Well, so my dad asked Tom if he would play some practice rounds with me on tour, and Tom said sure, but they're not going to be hitting giggles. It's not going to be playing for money every time we go out there. We're going to work, and you better have a yardage book in your pocket and not goof off. So I went out there a little scared, but I put a yardage book in my pocket every day. I still, to this day, I don't play a round of golf. I don't rely on my caddy to get the yardages. I don't, you know, if he screws up, I feel like it's my fault, because I have a yardage book in my pocket too. And we worked, you know, he didn't just play one ball and think about what he's going to have for dinner. He hit extra chips, extra putts. His caddy, Mike Carrick, where do you think we might need to chip from? He had a strategy to his practice round that got him prepared. And I think great players like Tom and Jack Nicklaus and Greg Norman, they were excellent at getting prepared to play golf tournament. So I was lucky to get to hang around with Kite, which meant I got to hang around with Crenshaw a lot too, and go out to a lot of dinners. The old line, go to dinner with good putters. I was hanging around players that were playing well and that were working hard. And yeah, if Tom Kite was sitting here, he'd say, yeah, but Davis helped me a lot with my swing. You know, he watched Peter Kostas or somebody give me a lesson, and he would help me. I remember one year at Bay Hill, I spent more time watching him hit balls than me hitting. And sure enough, getting to the end, he beats me in a playoff. And then the next week he wins the Players' Championship. And I'm like, golly, if I hadn't helped him, I could have won Bay Hill and maybe done better at the Players. And that year I missed the Masters just by, I think barely. I missed the top, whatever it was, 50 or 30 or whatever, just barely, and missed getting in the Masters in 80. When was that? 88, 89, somewhere in there. But anyway, I loved hanging around with him. There was no doubt in my mind who was going to introduce me at the Hall of Fame. It was Tom Kite, because he meant so much to my career. He was my connection, like my dad, to Harvey Pienick. You know, Tom really didn't realize what he had done for me until I asked him to introduce me at the Hall of Fame. He said, there's so many other people that could introduce you, you know? And I said, yeah, but you're the guy that's going to do it, because you had the biggest influence, other than my dad, really the biggest influence on my professional golf. You know, I lost my dad when I was 24. I was just barely on tour. So it was, I needed guys like Tom Kite, Raymond Floyd, Fred Couples around me to keep me going.
Well, they certainly did do that.
So, Davis, you won the North and South Amateur at Pinehurst in 84, and in 1984, you also won the Middle Atlantic Amateur, and then 85, you qualified for the Walker Cup team, which competed at Pine Valley. Jay Siegel was the captain. You had some great teammates. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
That was a dream of mine, was to play on the Walker Cup team, and at the time, the Walker Cup team qualified to play in the Masters. Jay Siegel was the captain, and playing it at Pine Valley, been a better place to play it, you know, staying right there on site. You had guys like Scott Verplank and Sam Randolph and Bob Lewis, Duffy Waldorf. We had an incredible team. It was fun to play. It was a highlight of my amateur career for sure. I never made it very far in the U.S. amateur, but Walker Cup was awesome, and I'll always remember that Walker Cup team.
So as Bruce did at the top of the show, let's just recap for our listeners. Davis Love's professional career, turning pro in 85 at age 21, 37 professional wins, including 21 PGA Tour victories, which, by the way, ties him for 31st on the all-time list currently. His highest ranking in the world, ranking second in 1998, he was top 10 for over 450 weeks. Obviously, the highlight is the 97 PGA Championship win at Wingfoot, which we will certainly talk about. But Bruce, what a record.
Wonderful record. And we mentioned at the top of the show, Davis's dad convinced him after he decided to turn pro that it would take him a couple of years. So after turning pro in 85, guess what happened? First victory, MCI Heritage Classic, and Davis won his first tournament nearly 2 years to the day. Pretty profound of your dad.
Well, he was ahead of his time on a lot of stuff, but he was really good at setting goals, telling me what to work on and what I could expect if I accomplished his laundry list of things to work on in my game. So unfortunately, he wasn't there for that win. He was on the lesson tee, as he always was, doing some Golf Digest schools, but kept up with me during the week. And he had set me on a great path, and I'm thrilled that even though we lost him in 88, he got to see me win a couple tournaments and get off to a good start on the tour.
So what was it about that event, Davis? I mean, it probably felt like a home, sort of a home venue for you, being so close to your home there in Hilton Head. But you won the event 5 times, so there had to be something about the vibe you got during that week coming off to the Masters, winning 5 times. You must have been comfortable just being there at the golf course. Something suited you.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. The week after the Masters, you know, obviously that's the first major of the year, and we're gearing up for that. And then, of course, later on, Players' Championship was moving dates, but the spring is time to be ready to play. And I think I was just ready to play in the spring. And then I grew up on Bermuda greens, overseeded Bermuda. I was comfortable with reading the grain. Back then, obviously, the greens weren't as pure a condition year-round as we see on the tour now. And I'd get to Hilton Head, or Andy Bean would get to Florida, and we felt like we had a little bit of an advantage. We grew up in the grain, and it wasn't confusing. Maybe I had a little bit of immunity to the sand gnats that pop out when the weather's nice at Hilton Head or Sea Island. So I think all things just aligned, and then you have to get lucky. I was luckier at Hilton Head than anywhere else. You know, I'd win a playoff, or I'd hole a shot or a chip when I needed it. I had kind of the same luck at Pebble Beach, not as great as Marco Mira. For some reason at Pebble, I got comfortable and the ball bounced my way more than, I think if you have a good attitude, you seem to get better breaks and you're a little bit more patient. And I was just always comfortable at Sea Pines.
So after the Sea Pine victory, a little bit of a gap there without winning on the tour. Did you find that you had more commitments after winning at MCI, or just struggled a little bit with the game?
I think, you know, still a rookie, you know, there for a couple of years. I had not played a whole lot of amateur golf, only 3 years in college. You know, I wasn't like Scott Verplank or some of those guys that came out, they played just hundreds and hundreds of big tournaments. So I was still learning the ropes, and it took me until 90, I guess, to win again. But obviously, the end of 88, it was a big adjustment, losing my dad, losing my coach, losing my friend, everything I'd done in golf. So I won't say that you know, slowed me down exclusively, but a lot of things kind of piled up. Like you said, your first win and having babies and growing up a little bit. I was a little bit rocky there for a while. And then when Butch Harmon kind of took me under his wing for a while, and then handed me off to Jack Lumpkin, I got more and more momentum as I got farther into my career. And obviously, the 90s and 2000s were really good to me for a long stretch.
So 1990, we're talking about that next victory. That was in the International. I don't think they have that anymore, but that was at Castle Pines. Different sort of format. People might remember that was a modified Stableford format, as I recall. Jack Vickers was sort of the patriarch of Castle Pines at the time, always famous for their milkshakes. What do you remember about that win? Because that's a different format. You guys just don't play that very often.
Well, yeah, the Stableford format at altitude. I remember playing a lot of rounds with Greg Norman, Vijay Singh, Ernie Els, guys that hit it a long way, could beat up the par fives out there it set up really nice for me. I wanted in a format where you had to make a cut every day. We played 5 days, and I just kept advancing through, and then got hot on Sunday. And then I also won it when they decided to accumulate Stableford points for 4 days. And I even liked that better because I got really rolling and got so far ahead going into Sunday that I really could play free and easy, knowing that I had a big points lead. But yeah, altitude out there was always good to me. There's a great club, and I always tended to play well on Jack's courses cut. I played a little bit similar game. I hit it a long way and brought it in high, so that suited that golf course for sure.
So then we go back to MCI again. Then in 1991, and you beat a fellow Australian of mine, Ian Baker Finch.
Well, yeah, I'd been working alongside Ian Baker Finch with Bob Rotella. We both kind of worked on the same things in our putting, and you better putt really well to beat IBF for a few years in there. And you know, again, I got lucky and made a few more putts than him. But you know, there, Greensboro, places that I was having success at, I was always looking forward to getting back and playing that golf course and keeping the momentum going. Who knows why the shortest golf course we probably play on the tour suited the longest hitter at that time. But I was lucky with caddies as well. My dad hooked me up with the great Herman Mitchell for my first win. I learned the ropes a little bit from him and learned how to play all different kinds of courses. But again, I just go back to, I was ready in the spring. I won the Players a couple times. I won all around the Masters, but didn't win the Masters. But I was always ready in the spring.
Yeah, you went on then in 1992 to win the Players Championship at TPC Sawgrass by 4 over again, IBF and Phil Blackmar, Nick Faldo, and Tom Watson. You had your brother Mark on the bag.
Yeah, Mark caddy. You know, he was at North Carolina with me as well, and then graduated from a college in Georgia, Valdosta State. So he was still playing some golf early in my career. But once I got a little bit established and he had some time, I started dragging him out there. And again, missing my dad, my brother knew my swing better than anybody. And he could remind me of just simple things like, hey, your practice swings, they're not looking really good. Let's get dialed in on them. Or, you know, Dr. Rotella said, let's get into the target. Growing up playing as kids, he could say things to me on the golf course that maybe a caddy would hesitate to say. He'd seen me in every situation, knew my golf swing. So it was a great partnership for a long time. You know, he had other things he wanted to do, but I kept dragging him out there. And, you know, what better, like Stuart Sink with his son now, to have a family member out there that you can trust in a pressure situation was great. And then obviously we went all the way and he won a major championship caddying for me and got to do a whole lot of cool things through golf, hanging out with me and traveling with me.
Take us back to that win, Davis. You were one back after 36, three back after 54 with a great final round. Just what are some of the memories of that round?
Well, for some reason, I had a lot of Sundays where I was behind a lot, and several times go out there on Sunday, let's just get into the game plan and shoot the lowest score you can. Thing you know, after 9, you're in the golf tournament. I did that Greensboro. I did it at Pebble. Some really hot rounds on Sunday. But again, the Players Championship, closest to home tournament, you know, it was an hour and a half away and Hilton Head was 2 hours away. Maybe sleeping in my own bed and being around home made me comfortable. But yeah, that Sunday I got on a really great roll. You know, even if I hit it offline somewhere, you know, I would chip in, or if I hit it in the woods, I could get it on the green. Breaks were going my way, but I was really rolling that time of year. That first year I won the Players and had gotten some wins, had a lot of confidence, you know, was running up against Fred Couples a bunch. And I think I just carried a lot of momentum into that Sunday and everything clicked.
Well, the momentum continued after that too, because after winning for the third time at the MCI. You went back to back and at the MCI and then the Kmart at Greensboro. So, boy, what a start to the year, 1992.
Yeah, I said I won everything around the Masters, and Fred won the Masters. So we had it all. Got a playoff at Riviera that Fred won. And then what was the best part about getting on that roll is Fred and I were asked to play in the World Cup. And that kind of cemented our playing relationship and our friendship. We got to play that 4 years in a row. And so 92 was a big jumping off point for me moving into international teams. You know, obviously 93 made the Ryder Cup team. I was a little bit in the mix with Dave Stockton in 91. He was considering picking me, which included me in the team talk and got me prepared for all of a sudden in 92, 93, started playing a bunch of international teams.
You mentioned that World Cup participation too. Four straight wins with your partner, which still stands as a record today, doesn't it?
I think Arnold and Jack won a bunch of them as well. You can't have a better partner than Fred Couples. One thing, if you said, what smart decisions did you make in your career? I was really good at picking partners. I played with Fred Couples and then played with the great Beth Daniel, who's a friend and was taking some lessons from my dad when I was getting started on tour. You take those three about anywhere and you can win some golf tournaments. So I was fortunate again that I was the long hitting guy that could make a bunch of birdies. I just needed somebody to partner with. So Fred and I played a lot of President's Cup matches, World Cups, not as many Ryder Cup matches as we would have liked. We were on the same team a few times and for some reason just didn't get paired up as much in Ryder Cup, but it was a thrill to be able to go. We went to Spain first to play the Ryder Cup. I mean the World Cup, and Fred, that's when his back was starting to go out. He got off to a rough start, and I held us in there the first day, and then he got on a roll in the middle, and then I made a couple birdies coming down the stretch, and we won it. And once we won it, I think after that, it was a big goal for us to keep rolling, to win it every year. Obviously, we were the favorite team, which made it hard, but two scores a day added up. It's not an easy format. You better have somebody you're having fun with and can trust when you both have to add 272-hole scores together to win. And we cruised to a couple easy ones, but that first one was tough in Spain. And once we got that, unfortunately, I think it was his mom passed away. We didn't get to defend at Kiowa. Justin Leonard filled in, and the streak was over. But World Cup memories, I made some great friendships through that and got to spend a whole bunch of time with Freddie. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And Bruce had an opportunity, too, with his good friend, David Graham, to win a World Cup. But I don't think the crowd was as well behaved at yours, Bruce, as it might have been for the ones Davis played in.
No, Davis will get a kick out of this. We were playing with DiVincenzo and his partner the last day, and I hit my drive down the fairway on the first hole, a little dogleg to the right, and when I got down there, I couldn't find my ball, and I found it was in the right rough, right behind a tree, and that was how the last day got started. So it was a pretty rough day, but David ended up playing great that day, and we ended up winning, which was nice. It's always, like you said, it's always great to play for your country and win.
For sure.
David said he flew down to Argentina in coach and came back in first class. Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast, on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway, it went smack down the fairway.
Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.